Group meeting, Sunday, 30th September, 1984. Let me start today with a few words from the Heart of Religion in the chapter on Krishnamurti. It's just the first page. When time's discord bruises life, the light of heaven dims. Groping and crying in the dark, man sickens with fear and sorrow. Note those two very carefully, fear and sorrow. Enfeebled, he cannot be wise or virtuous, but becomes the slave of authority, of the leader, the system, the ideology, the church, the book, the guru, the popular idol. Such authority loads him with the chains of creeds and beliefs which are but verbal vapors, and confines his life to the treadmill of custom and convention. Slaveholder and slave are wretchedly alike. Ignorant, dull, inept, emasculated. Neither can see that the worm-eaten staircase in their house of dereliction is no way to heaven. When the primal liberating vision of truth fades, man blurs life's fact with some foolish fiction. Instruct the self-appointed, stony custodians of this fiction, authoritarians who bandage your eyes and torture you if you say you are unable either to see what they assert you ought to see, or to believe without question what you are ordered to believe. When at last the times decay and men groan for the lifting of the darkness, there arises one in whom the white-hot pulse of life bursts through and shatters the gloom. Springtime again, exulting in new creation. Be simple and see heaven's light enfolding earth, and hear time conversing with life, intoning timeless silence. There is one other phrase, practically, I want to read to you. This is by the Buddha. It comes in one of the long discourses in the third volume of the Digha Nikaya. The Buddha is talking about the Arahant, the perfected Holy One, the one whom I would call the true human, one who, a member of our species, who has reached the culminating point of his development as a member of that particular species. And he mentions 9 things which are impossible for such a person to do. And one of them is this. He cannot go astray through fear. That simple phrase, as far as I'm aware, has never been expanded and properly explained in any of the texts. Have you ever seen Any expansion of that statement in the Buddhist texts? I haven't come across one yet. But it is very, very, that statement is extremely significant. He cannot go astray through fear. And with fear, I would also associate sorrow. Freedom from fear is indispensable for living the religious life. If one lives the religious life because he is afraid that he might go to hell after death, well then, he is making a great mistake. It is impossible for such a person to live religiously in the true sense of the word religion. Because consider, what is the meaning of the word religion? I put it this way in this book. Whatsoever purifies an individual, whatsoever relates him rightly to all men and to his whole environment, and whatsoever awakens the sense of transcendence in him, so that finally it culminates in a holistic consciousness which includes the totality. That is religion. Out of such a conception, I believe, which the great founders of the religions themselves must have held, out of that conception, the followers produced systems of beliefs, rituals, and rules and regulations of life which were supposed to represent religion. But religion, coming from the Latin religare, means to bind back. I would rather put it this way, to return oneself back to the source from which one emerged. That is religion in the real sense. That source, of course, is what human beings see, feel, ultimately perhaps realize as transcendence itself. Call it God if you like, call it Brahman, call it Allah, Aromazda, or any other word you like. But that which is the transcendent, the unknown and the unknowable by the human brain, that is the source which becomes all this, of which we are integral part and parcel. Note carefully, integral part and parcel. Because if we weren't integral part and parcel, it would not be possible to be rightly related to anything and everything, to any person and every person. This is very important, really, because this being related rightly means that the sense of transcendence is already working within oneself, and one is beginning to awaken to the fact that the primordial creative energy of transcendence, by self-constriction, becomes all this. The human body has evolved out of an animal ancestor, and we are classed, as a matter of fact, as members, as one of the animal species. The physical body as such is a member of an animal species as such. It has evolved from the higher primates, the prosimians, the monkeys, the lemurs, and the hominoids, and finally the hominids, the humans as such. We have evolved out of all that. And we bear in our constitution, and particularly in our brains, the entire story of that evolutionary process. But what is not, what the scientists, of course, do not say, and of course they cannot, as scientists, say such things. It is outside their sphere, as they would quite legitimately say, is that this evolutionary process is a process in which transcendence itself, by self-constriction, descends lower and lower in consciousness and more in terms of concretization. Structure becomes more and more prominent. And this greater prominence of structure is necessary for the right sort of happy development of function. When function has developed rightly and happily, and in us transcendence is embodied, people have talked about the spark of the divine spark in each and every one, or the immortal spirit and so forth. All those phrases represent this embodied transcendence in us. Now, it is essential not just to believe such statements. Do not believe them. Challenge them. Consider them. Mull over them carefully, very, very carefully, and constantly. Because if you merely believe, you will become the slave of an ephemeral picture projected out of your own brain, your own psyche. Consider very carefully, examine all the time. What did the Buddha say? Samasati, constant mindfulness. Out of how many million Buddhists are there in the world today? 300-400 million, maybe? You see? Out of the 300-400 millions, how many really understand or have begun to understand the intensity involved in the meaning of samasati, perfect mindfulness, perfect wakefulness? This mindfulness is important for this reason. One of the great purposes, this is my own idea, so you can reject it out of hand if you wish. One of the great purposes of our existence, the human species, the existence of the human species, is that what is the actuality which is named mind will flower out into perfection. Now, what is mind? Everybody in the world says mind, my mind, your mind, his mind, a fine mind, a noble mind, a wretched mind, an evil mind. We say all these things. What on earth do we mean by mind? Have we begun to know what mind actually is, substantially, so to say? I put it this way. It is an archetypal form of the primordial creative energy which, in releasing a cosmos into being, produces order and infuses the ability for self-knowing to start with, a self-knowing which becomes ultimately an all-knowing, an omniscience. not in the encyclopedic sense, but in this sense, that there is that faculty within us, because transcendence is within us, there is that faculty within us which can become aware of anything and everything as soon as it is in contact with it, and can become aware of its essential nature. Words alone are hopeless, really. One can go on and on like this for a long time, but we must pass on. Now, if we look into what prevents us from realizing this state within us, one of the primary obstructions is fear. Fundamentally, we are afraid of death. And under that statement, the fear of death, you can collect all the other types of fear that we experience in life. The fear of loss of property, possessions, status, or whatever it is, you see. A fear of emotional fear of losing the loved one, and so forth, or all the loved ones. The fear of where will I find my next meal? Haven't got a job, and that sort of thing. All kinds of fears come up. Fear of the dark, which starts right from infancy practically with most people. Fear of the unknown. And it is a curious thing that we are afraid of the unknown simply because it is unknown. It is strange to us. It is different from us. And we instinctively feel afraid that it will hurt us because it is unknown. But these are all irrational fears. And the whole host of these fears do come under the fundamental fear, the fear of death. It is our business to understand death. We know that the one unchanging characteristic of the entire cosmos is constant change. But what is the meaning of constant change? Here, at this moment, this exists as such. In the next moment, and the moment after that, it is undergoing change. But in undergoing change, this has died to its first state. The second state is the birth into a new state. Therefore, this is dying into a new state, actually. Birth is actually a dying into a new state. Consider the ordinary biological situation, a human fetus. It has to die to its state within the womb in order to be born. That is a real meaning of death as such. A change which is a transformation into something new. Something rich and strange, if you like, to use Shakespeare's words. If we do not die to the old, which actually is now here, if we do not die to the old, we will never grow. We will become fossils. A fossil is an example of death in the unchanging state, in the inactive state. It's fossilized, it's finished with, as such. So, if we understand death, really understand it, see it for what it actually is, the fear of death goes. This is not a theory. I'm telling you something which is factual. You can take death in your stride from instant to instant then. Every moment of your life. And since you can take death from instant to instant, you are participating in the creative process of the emergence of the new. Then you see, there is an extraordinary peace and a calm within oneself. You are not concerned. Oh, I'll lose this. Or it will cause me awful pain. There is no such thing as loss or gain in the world. These are illusions from which we suffer. We think we have gained something because that which we desired, we now grasp in our own hands. But whatever you grasp in your own hand grasps you and prevents your development onwards. People never realize that. Take a man who makes a million, we'll say, has a great mansion to live in or some such thing. How much does he spend on his lawyer, his doctor, his estate agent, etc., etc.? How much trouble does he have in that connection? You see, that which he possesses, the mansion has grasped him and imprisoned him because he desires it. He grasps it with his heart and his soul, and that's the trouble. Ananda, said the Buddha, the complete freedom from all grasping is indeed deathlessness, immortality. You see, you can experience immortality here and now, and from this moment, or from this place onwards, till the end of your days, if you see this and remain awake to it. Not just be conscious of it in some fixed way. Every fixation is a bondage. But be awake to it. The awakened state is the living state. The unawakened state is a sort of a dead state or a fossilized state. See how marvelous the human body is. Even in sleep, it is not unawakened. You dream. That is one thing which happens. But the brain is constantly working even in sleep. The various organs of the body, the flow of the bloodstream, the working of the lungs, the beating of the heart, all that goes on and on and on. It is doing its job. It's doing its business. And in doing its business, it is flowering out. So you see, it is so important to realize this awakened state. And this awakened state is the real meaning of enlightenment, the first and foremost meaning. You know how when we have some difficult problem to face and so forth, and we work upon it, or we meet somebody who considers it with us, and suddenly we say, oh yes, I see that. You have awakened to it in this extraordinary manner. That awakened state can be maintained throughout life, so that when life presents you with anything whatsoever, whether it be pleasurable or painful, easy or difficult, terrible and horrible, or wonderful, and ecstatic. You just take it in your stride. You are living in the real sense. You live through life that way. What extraordinary misconceptions human beings all the world over have about living. They say, oh, that, look at that man, he's a life button, isn't he? He eats, he drinks, he enjoys himself all the time. That's all they have to say about it. He eats, he drinks. They omit the fact that he eliminates also. Because if he didn't eliminate, they don't understand that if he didn't eliminate, he would essentially, inevitably cease to eat and drink afterwards, because he'd be dead. How marvelously Shakespeare wrote, "Lord, what fools these mortals be." So now, with the disappearance of the fundamental fear, all other fears also disappear. That is to say, the stimulus which ordinarily produces fear, the event, the external circumstance, or whatever it is, can be terrible, can be horrible, but you won't be afraid. That's the point. Supposing this house suddenly caught fire, how many of us would be not afraid? Oh, I've got my manuscript to look after. I must snatch it and save it, my precious manuscript, which is going to save the world and all that nonsense. Oh, my wife is here, my little child is here, etc. Grab the manuscript, take the wife and the child out, quietly, coolly, quickly. Otherwise, you'll spill it. You'll drop it. See this extraordinary inward calm, this balanced, imperturbable state finds its home inside your whole being. Yeah. And that is important. And when fear has gone, you will discover that its going, its disappearance, is due to the fact that one has woken up to the fact that one is transcendence embodied. If one doesn't wake up to that fact, fear won't go. Because only when you really awake to the fact that you are transcendence embodied, all the isolativeness and the separativeness of self-consciousness has vanished. As long as we are isolatively and separatively self-conscious, we are always going to remain subhuman. And in so many cases in the world, we see too many examples cropping up nowadays, we remain inhuman, not only subhuman. Look at the terrible things we hear on the news about the cruelty of man to man, the murder of children and all the rest of it. We hear it every day. So you see, because the individual person is separatively and isolatively self-conscious, he inevitably does wrong. Because this is the fundamental sin. Whatsoever hurts, denies, destroys, upsets the unity of the universe, that is the fundamental meaning of the word sin. And so, through my own separative, isolative self-consciousness, I am a sinner. The Catholics were quite right when they said that man is born in sin. But I should like to meet the Catholic out of the, how many, about 1800 million Catholics in the world today or something like that, who really understands the meaning of that statement that man is born in sin. It's very unlikely that you will meet any Catholic who will say, yes, it is because I am separatively and isolatively self-conscious that I am a sinner. So now, with the disappearance of these things, what happens to sorrow in life? Sorrow also completely disappears. Physical pain, of course, will be there. Sorrow is psychological pain. The physical body is so made that in the physical world as such, if something hits you or falls on your head or something, of course you will be hurt. But that is not sorrow. That is pain, ordinary pain in the physical sense. Sorrow is psychological. It generally means not obtaining what one desires. Or, as we say, commonly say, losing what one possesses, which one has desired and wants to continue to possess. So sorrow also completely disappears. Why? When self-consciousness, which is separative and isolative, has disappeared, there is only this awakening to a transcendent consciousness. And the transcendent consciousness holds all, has all, is all. What is there to grasp? Nothing at all. I wonder how many Buddhists have penetrated very deeply into the Buddha's statement, the freedom from all grasping, physical, psychological, mental, artistic, religious, transcendent. Be free of all that grasping. Look at the number of people, well-meaning people, sincere people, but rather lacking in the top story of the building, say, I must find God. Did you ever meet a fish which said, I must find water? Or a bird which said, I must find air. Where is it? Where is it? I'm searching for air. Similarly, mortals, some mortals, many mortals in fact, must find God. When God is the everything here and now, all the time. If then one not merely accepts this with a little brain work, accepts this as, well, it sounds logical, it must be true. Just because it is logical, it need not be true. If it is logical, it may be part of the truth, undoubtedly, you see. But the whole truth is logical and illogical, and transcending both, it is illogical. Because you see, in the realm of truth in the absolute, there is no room for logic. Logic is a thing which is restricted to the human kingdom and the workings of the human brain. What is logic? A string of words. They all represent something separate, something different, something limited and little. Not the whole thing. Say to yourself, day after day, I am God. I am the totality. Now see what happens. either you will become very foolishly conceited person, crazy person, or you will become free of all the limitations which oneself as a subhuman member of the species, you see, experiences. So then, with that, all sorrow necessarily disappears. And if one is free from fear and free from sorrow, then you know happiness, joy in the true sense. Then you know bliss. I think the best word is not in the English language. It's in Sanskrit. Ananda. There is a magic about that word, ananda. It's an utterly peaceful happiness, a peaceful joy, a bliss that is ineffable. You will experience that. I assure you, you will experience it. You see? And in that state of ananda, that imperturbable condition within oneself, free of fear, free of sorrow, and therefore also free of all isolative, separative consciousness, whatsoever you do in thought, word, and deed will inevitably be right, it will be good, and you will be a blessing to the world in which you live. That is the sort of thing I wish for all the members of these groups which meet here. If we can really see this, the seeing is the thing which works like magic. And remember, the seeing is not merely a logical brain seeing. It is being what you see. You have become what you have seen. You have become that bliss. You have become that purity, that goodness, that truth, in mind and consciousness. But you are essentially mind and consciousness, because essentially we are all religious beings, and only secondarily are we any other sort of being. We are economic animals or political animals or social animals. And I say all these things because you may remember, those of you who were present at the August weekend, we talked a bit about the renovation of the world. You are the world, each one individually. I am the world. Insofar as each one of us is completely renovated within himself, the whole world experiences the fruit of that renovation. Take a simple practical example. A man of genius invents something which is very useful, which is beneficial and helpful in living daily life, we'll say. Now you see, he invented it, but he is not the only one who is going to benefit from it and use it. Everybody will benefit from it and use it. You see? So if you and I become renovated beings, truly human beings, truly religious beings, the whole world inevitably experiences the benefit of your renovation, of my renovation. And also remember that it is not your or my renovation. It is transcendence itself which has realized its own transcendence in this particular form, the human species. And can anything be more wonderful, really, more attractive, I'm using a poor word, than that sort of thing? You see, in the past, things have been presented in unfortunate ways. Fight the good fight. All right, fight the good fight, you will only perpetuate fighting. Overcome evil, you won't. If anybody tells me, overcome evil, I will say to him, I am the evil. I can't overcome myself. But what I can do is to transform it, to transmute the evil into the good. Because all that is evil in me is my own psychophysical energy, my own electrochemical forces at work, which have found an expression which is disharmonious. If, for instance, I do this with both hands or with one hand alone on the piano, you won't hear a pleasant tune. You'll hear a row. You see, it's like that. So simple, isn't it? It really is so easy. Because if one can somehow or other get at the essential thing, it just works a miracle. Everything else suddenly changes. You know how sometimes on cloudy days, very cloudy days, there's no sunshine, it's all grey and dark, and suddenly perhaps a wind comes along and removes the clouds, and everything is absolutely lighted up. And you know you're feeling, oh my goodness, look at the sun, it's wonderful. Life is like that. Man has to be like that. So be happy and carry on.